Okay, so my brief was to talk about triangulations of hyperbolic manifolds, surfaces, and three manifolds. To do this, various models of hyperbolic space are going to appear. So maybe there are four models on the screen. There's the upper half plane model, where you take the part of the hyperbolic, the complex plane above the x-axis, where the imaginary part's positive. And on there, there's a metric, the hyperbolic metric. And the hyperbolic metric is given by taking the Euclidean metric and scaling it by the reciprocal of how high up you are above the x-axis. So it's 1 over y times Euclidean metric. So in other words, it's conformally equivalent to the Euclidean metric. And so if you do that, the geodesics are of two kinds. You have vertical lines and semicircles, which are orthogonal to the x-axis. And if you take two points on the same vertical line, then, of course, by integrating 1 over y, you find the hyperbolic distance between those two points is the logarithm of their ratio. And the horizontal lines in this picture are things called horocycles. So vertical lines are geodesics, they're distance minimizing. There's a unique geodesic between any pair of points in the upper half plane. These horizontal green lines are not geodesic, they're called horocycles. Those should be thought of as circles of infinite radius, where the center of the circle is the point at infinity. So one has a group of isometries, the orientation preserving isometries of the upper half plane are given by real Möbius transformations that preserve the upper half plane. So z goes to az plus b over cz plus d, a, b, c, d are real numbers, and with the condition that it preserves the upper half plane. So this is a group, think of this as a group PSL2R. But there's another model. You can map the upper half plane by a conformal map, z minus I over z plus I, to the unit disk. And so over here we have the so-called disk model of the hyperbolic plane. And here, geodesics are straight lines and arcs of circles that are orthogonal to the unit circle. And the point at infinity under this particular map corresponds to the point 1 on the unit circle. And these horocycles, in this, once you've done this transformation, actually become Euclidean circles tangent to the unit circle in the interior. And so vertical lines are geodesics in the upper half space model, which are asymptotic to the point infinity in the upper half space model. So that's the point 1 on the unit circle. And those geodesics are orthogonal to these horocycles. Now, there are two more models that are going to appear, the so-called hyperboloid model and the projective model. So for the hyperboloid model, here we are in R3, and you take the one sheet of the hyperboloid, z squared is x squared plus y squared plus 1. And then points on the hyperboloid correspond to points in the hyperbolic plane. And there's a group of linear transformations of R3, the subgroup SO21, the subgroup of linear transformations that preserve the quadratic form of signature 2-1, that preserve the... they preserve this hyperboloid. The set of vectors of length 1 for that quadratic form is, it's this cone here. It's got equation z squared equals x squared plus y squared. So in this model, this hyperboloid is a hyperbolic plane. And then the projective model, if you take the plane z equals 1 in R3, the part of it lying inside the light cone, that's the projective model. And the identification between the hyperboloid model and the projective model is given by radially projecting from the origin. And in this model, geodesics in the projective model are actually given by Euclidean straight lines. In fact, you can think of a geodesic in the projective model. If you take a linear plane going through the origin where it intersects the this disk, that's a line in the projective model, and where it slices through the hyperboloid, that's geodesic in the hyperboloid model. So those are the four models of hyperbolic plane. So the next thing to do is to describe the isometries in a bit more detail geometrically. So there are three kinds of isometry. Hyperbolic, elliptic, parabolic. I'm not going to talk about elliptic. So first of all, hyperbolic isometry. In the upper half plane model, if you pick a positive real number lambda, then multiplying by lambda z goes to lambda z preserves the upper half plane. It actually preserves the positive y-axis. So the y-axis I've drawn red here is invariant. And it sends some point on the y-axis to another point. The y-axis is a geodesic. So this means that points on the y-axis move to other points. And if you compute the distance they're moved, well, it's the logarithm of lambda. So the y-axis is preserved by this hyperbolic, and points are moved along their hyperbolic distance lambda. In the disk model, the y-axis becomes the diameter of the unit circle going from 1 to minus 1. Remember, infinity, my arrow should probably be going the other way. And in fact, the great thing about a document camera is one can do that. So under this map, infinity goes to 1, so my picture consistent. So in the disk model, there's a Möbius transformation mapping the unit disk to itself that moves points in this direction. I've indicated two straight lines coming out of the origin, and they have the property that the region in between these lines consists of a set of points of a fixed hyperbolic distance from this axis for the hyperbolic. These lines don't come into the x-axis orthogonally, so they're not geodesics, they're not length minimizing, they have curvature. They're equidistant curves. In the disk model, these lines kind of become curves, and they enclose, again, the subset of the hyperbolic plane within some fixed distance. The distance depends on this angle here. If one quotients out the hyperbolic plane by this, you fix a lambda, you quotient out the hyperbolic plane by this hyperbolic, one gets a hyperbolic cylinder. And one way to think of that is that I've drawn here two geodesics that are orthogonal to the y-axis. The one that goes endpoints 1 and minus 1, the other endpoints lambda and minus lambda. And this transformation takes the inner one to the outer one. So the region in between is a fundamental domain. And when one quotients out, you take this region in between, you identify the inner circle with the outer circle, you get this, topologically it's just a cylinder. In the middle of it, you get a closed red geodesic, the image of the y-axis, the length of that geodesic is the logarithm of lambda, that's its length. The image of these lines, each one of these lines is mapped itself by this hyperbolic. The image of one of these lines becomes a closed curve on this annulus. And the length of this curve, well, it depends on the angle here. It depends on how far this curve is from this geodesic. This is the unique closed geodesic on the quotient on this hyperbolic surface. And if your distance r from that geodesic, then the length of this curve is approximately e to the power r times the length of the core curve. So this kind of funnel, it's flaring out, it's growing in size rapidly. So that's the quotient of the hyperbolic plane by the cyclic group generated by a single hyperbolic. Now for a parabolic, if one takes the Möbius transformation z goes to z plus a, a is a real number here, actually it's positive in this example. So that takes the y-axis to the axis with x-coordinate a. It's a Euclidean translation, it's also a hyperbolic isometry. The region in between these two axes is a fundamental domain for this. Over in the disk model, the corresponding picture is that these two vertical geodesics asymptotic to the point at infinity become two geodesics in the disk model asymptotic to the point 1 on the unit circle. And the region in between is this region in between here. I've drawn a couple of Horow cycles and the corresponding Horow cycles in the plane. Euclidean translation preserves each one of these Horow cycles. When we quotient out the hyperbolic plane by this parabolic, you take this strip in the hyperbolic plane, you identify one side to the other side by Euclidean translation, that's also a hyperbolic translation. And again, what you get topologically is an annulus, but the metric on it is different this time. This is called a cusp. And the point is that you remember that the hyperbolic metric is the Euclidean metric divided by how high you are in the Euclidean sense above the x-axis. So that means that the lengths of these parts of the Horow cycle and the fundamental domain are going to zero. So the corresponding loops on this surface are shrinking. And in fact, as you move out a distance r into the cusp, you find that the length of this curve is like e to the minus r. So that's the quotient of the hyperbolic plane by a parabolic. And one final comment is, you can think of this as a limiting situation of that. So if you take one of these gadgets, so you have a hyperbolic translation by a length lambda, and now you let lambda go to zero. So what you see here is a metric space where the length of this curve is going to zero. Well, you can take a limit to Gromov-Hausdorff limit with the base point going this way, and when you do that, you get a cusp. So you can think of this as a limit of this as the length goes to zero. Another way to think about that is that you're taking a sequence of hyperbolic translations along axes. Here I'm depicting them in the disk model. The axes are going to infinity in the disk model, and the length you're translating along them is getting shorter and shorter. And if you do that in the correct way, that exhibits this parabolic as a geometric limit of these hyperbolics, corresponding to this geometric description here. So the next thing is to talk about triangles. So here's the disk model. So a triangle is a region bounded by three arcs of geodesics. So here's a triangle with angles alpha, beta, gamma. The area is the angle defect, the amount by which the sum of the angles differ from pi. Here I've taken a limit of a triangle as one of the vertices goes off to infinity. And this is a triangle with one ideal vertex at infinity and two finite vertices. Taking all three vertices to infinity, one gets a so-called ideal triangle. As the vertex goes to infinity, the angle decreases to zero, so the angles in the ideal triangle are zero, its area is pi. There's a unique Mobius transformation sending any 3 points to any other 3 points. So that means that any ideal triangle can be mapped to any other ideal triangle by an isometry, a Mobius transformation preserving the unit disk. So the summary is that triangles are parameterized up to isometry by the angles alpha, beta, gamma. And the conditions on these three numbers, they're greater than or equal to zero, less than pi, and their sum is strictly less than pi. And so that's the isometry. That's the classification of triangles up to isometry. Now what we want to do is construct hyperbolic surfaces by gluing together triangles. In fact, we're going to be gluing together ideal triangles. So up to isometry, there is one ideal triangle. We're going to form a surface eventually by gluing together ideal triangles by identifying an edge of one ideal triangle with an edge of another ideal triangle by an isometry. And now a modulus comes into play. When you glue an edge of one ideal triangle to an edge of another ideal triangle, there are choices, and the choices correspond to real number. And so there are different ways to think of that. First of all, there's the extrinsic way. If you have two hyperbolic triangles in the plane that share an edge, then they determine 4 points on the circle, the unit circle, points A, B, C, D. And if you take the cross ratio of those 4 points in a certain order, that corresponds to thinking of A mapping to 0, B mapping to 1, C mapping to infinity, and then where D maps to is a complex number, actually a real number T, which lies in the range from 1 to infinity, a positive real number. So that's a kind of so from that point of view, there are no, if you have 3 points on the circle, there are no moduli. Mobius transformation taking any 3 points to any other 3 points. When you have 4 points, there's an invariant, the cross ratio. So that's an extrinsic way of thinking about, if you have two ideal triangles glued together, how to assign a number to them. On the other hand, there's an intrinsic way to think about the invariant when you glue two triangles together. When you have an ideal triangle, there is a hyperbolic circle which is tangent to the three sides of a triangle. And that picks out a point on each edge of the triangle, which you might think of as the midpoint. So when you have an ideal triangle, the fact you've got, you have a side of an ideal triangle, you've got a point which you can think of as the midpoint. Well, when you glue two ideal triangles together, this line gets two points on it, one because there's a midpoint coming from one side, and one a midpoint from the other side. And if you take the distance between those 2 points, that's a number called L. And in fact, that number is the logarithm of T minus 1. Now, of course, a length is positive, but it actually makes sense to think of this as a length which can be positive or negative. So as t varies between 1 and infinity, log of t minus 1 takes on any real value. And the way to interpret that is, if you stand in one triangle and you walk up to the edge, the number L is how far you have to move to the left in order to get to the other midpoint. So it's a positive number if the triangle you're walking into, the midpoint is to the left, and it's negative if you move to the right. The summary is that moving left is a positive action and moving right is a negative action. So that's the kind of intrinsic point of view.
So these are oriented triangles?
Everything I'm going to talk about today, we have an orientation. We fix an orientation on the hyperbolic plane, and we're only thinking about orientation preserving maps. So so now we can parameterize ideal n-gons. So there's only one ideal triangle up to isometry. For an ideal quadrilateral, well, an ideal quadrilateral, you can subdivide it by putting a diagonal in, so it's two ideal triangles. And I just argued that two ideal triangles are classified up to isometry by one real number. So in a similar way, one sees that an ideal polygon with n sides, so I've indicated one here in the unit disk with seven sides, so ideal n-gons are parameterized up to isometry by n minus 3 real numbers. And to do that, you pick some triangulation. You subdivide this n-gon into ideal triangles. And you'll need n minus 3 interior edges to do that. There are many ways to do it, but you fix one. And then each one of these interior edges separates two ideal triangles, so it picks up there's a real number assigned to each edge, which tells you how far you have to go to the left when you cross. And so in this way, you get the parameterization of isometry classes of n-gon by real numbers. So now I want to use that idea to classify isometry, so hyperbolic metrics on surfaces. So let's think about the case of a punctured torus. So there's a two-parameter family of complete finite volume hyperbolic structures on a once-punctured torus. And here's one way to think about it. You can think about a once-punctured torus. Well, if you take a pair of ideal triangles in the hyperbolic plane, and I've glued these two triangles together along one edge, and then there's going to be one isometry that glues this pair of opposite edges so the arrows match, and another isometry that identifies the red pair of edges so the sides match. So when I do that, I get three real numbers. I get one number. So another way to think about it, when I glue opposite edges, we get a punctured torus. And on that punctured torus, we have three geodesics that start and end in the cusp. There's a blue one, a red one, a green one. And each one of those geodesics picks up a real number. So there are three real numbers. Any assignment of three real numbers gives you a unique way to glue these ideal triangles together and will give you a hyperbolic structure on the torus. But that hyperbolic structure typically won't be complete. The condition that you get a complete hyperbolic structure is that the sum of the coordinates is zero. In fact... Actually, where that comes from is you walk around, as you go around the cusp, you're supposed to have a parabolic. Well, in fact, the holonomy around the cusp, you cross every geodesic twice, so the holonomy you have around the cusp is, generically, it's a hyperbolic translation by a length twice the sum of these three coordinates. And the condition that this is a complete structure is that that's actually parabolic, so that that number should be zero. So the condition for a complete structure is this is parabolic, so one gets from that the Titmuller space of finite volume complete hyperbolic structures on a punctured torus can be thought of as this subspace of R3, R2. And of course, you can imagine now how you would handle, a punctured surface of higher genus, just using more triangles. Suppose, though, one wants to triangulate a closed surface using ideal triangles, then there's a slight subtlety. So now we don't have a puncture anymore. What I'm going to do is describe how a closed surface can be expressed as a finite number of ideal triangles together with a finite number of simple closed curves. And The way to do this involves this notion of it's called spinning a triangulation. So here I've got a closed compact surface genus 2, and on it a simple closed curve gamma that separates the surface into two punctured tori. And on this, so you should think of this as a hyperbolic surface and gamma as a geodesic. And on this surface, there's a geodesic that starts and ends at some point on gamma. And over here, I've drawn the universal cover. This is the hyperbolic plane. And the red loop looks to be some arc in the hyperbolic plane starting and ending on two pre-images of gamma. So now, what I can do is I can put my finger on the point where this red arc is attached to gamma and start dragging it. So if I move that point upwards, there will be a unique geodesic in this homotopy class that starts and ends at the dragged point. If you think what's going on in the universal cover, as I drag the point where this red geodesic attached to the green arc, well, I'm actually moving it in the direction of the arrow. So what's happening is that this endpoint is moving upwards, this endpoint is moving downwards, and in the new position, the red arc upstairs now goes like this. Well, you now carry on. You push this point more and more, round and round, and if you think what's going on in the universal cover, in the limit, the red arc is no longer finite in length, it's an infinite geodesic, with endpoints, the two endpoints of these two pre-images of gamma. Down on the surface, what you see is, instead of seeing a red geodesic of finite length, you see this red geodesic that spins round and round. It converges, it limits on this closed geodesic gamma.
Phil?
Yeah?
Are some of the green arrows turned around? Looks to me like the green arrow should be parallel, not anti-parallel, because the translation is your orientation to the green.
Let's see. You're probably right. I don't have green chalk. Oh, yes, I do. You can't see green chalk, but never mind. So there's green chalk. And so I come out this way, I come in that way. So when I go out, when I come in, so if I straighten that out, well, yeah. So it's correct up to arrows, and I'm not. I don't know which is which. You're probably right. You have to change the arrows, but yeah. In which case, this would have gone this way. So one could imagine, instead of if one has not one geodesic on this punctured torus, but in fact three, if I take three geodesics on this right-hand punctured torus, I'm in the situation on the previous piece of paper where I had a triangulation of a punctured torus with two ideal triangles. So if I add those two geodesics here, that splits up the right-hand punctured torus topologically into two triangles. And if I now do that spinning construction simultaneously on all those geodesics, what one ends up with is, on the right-hand side, two ideal triangles. You do the same thing on the left-hand side. So the summary is that this surface can be formed by taking four ideal triangles and kind of gluing them together, except that when you do that, this curve gamma is going to be missing. So we'll have a punctured torus on the right-hand side, a punctured torus on the left-hand side. Those will actually have incomplete hyperbolic structures on them, because this isn't a parabolic, this is a hyperbolic. So what we've actually got is this surface F, there's a geodesic lamination on it. In this case, it's just a simple closed curve. And the complement of this simple closed curve is made up of ideal triangles. Actually, I think I'm thinking of the lamination here as including those geodesics. I'm actually imagining cutting the surface along this closed geodesic together with these geodesics that spiral. So there's, in this example, there's four ideal triangles. And then there's data that describes how those triangles together. There are these real numbers I talked about on the other transparency. So I've divided this surface up into two punctured tori. Each punctured torus has three triangles. Those three triangles have three edges. So I get three numbers from the left-hand punctured torus, three numbers from the right-hand punctured torus, a total of six real numbers. Now, for the complete hyperbolic structure on a punctured torus, we had the extra condition that the sum of the coordinates is zero. Here we don't have that anymore. The sum of the coordinates on the left-hand punctured torus, L1 plus L2 plus L3, actually twice that number, is the length of this geodesic. So there's a compatibility condition on the three parameters on the right-hand punctured torus and the three parameters on the left-hand punctured torus. The compatibility condition is this linear equation, that L1 plus L2 plus L3 is L4 plus L5 plus L6. It's saying that the incomplete structure on the right-hand side and the incomplete structure on the left-hand side produce hyperbolics for the separating curve with the same translation length. So we had six parameters. We've imposed one equation. That's down to five parameters. But now there's one more parameter here. There's a twisting. So the way the ideal triangles are glued on the right-hand side and the way they're glued on the left-hand side isn't quite the whole picture, because when you put these two punctured tori together, there's one more twisting parameter. And so there are five coordinates from here and a twisting parameter, giving you a total of six parameters. In general, for a closed surface, you get three times the absolute value of the Euler characteristic parameters. What was the question?
Is that called the space of geodesic lamination?
No, this is an example of a geodesic lamination. So the kind of summary here is that we've got a collection of ideal triangles, in this case six. We've identified sides of some of them, and that doesn't give the entire surface. In this case, actually, it gives the surface minus this simple closed curve. So, yeah. Here's another example, actually, of a... here I'm starting off with actually a simpler situation. A pair of pants, a sphere with three punctures. A hyperbolic structure on a sphere with three punctures can be made by taking two ideal triangles and doubling. So if we put parameters of zero on all three edges, that gives the unique complete hyperbolic structure on a three-punctured sphere, otherwise known as a pants. On the other hand, the set of possible hyperbolic structures on this pants, complete or incomplete, are specified by these three real numbers. And in general, if you take these parameters, L1, L2, L3, on these three kinds of edge, what you get is a metric on the pants. Typically, it's an incomplete metric. These triangles, so maybe you can kind of see it, but this surface is made of two triangles, and here they're kind of spiraling in to a closed geodesic that isn't there. If you take the metric completion, there'll be a closed geodesic on these three boundary components. And the lengths of these geodesics, well, I mean, here it's L2 plus L3, and there it's L1 plus L3, and so on. So actually, this gives another way to think about putting a hyperbolic structure on a surface using a Pants decomposition. Here I've taken a genus 2 surface and cut it along three disjoint simple closed curves, kind of shown dotted, cutting the surface up into three pairs of pants. And then each of those pants I can think of as two ideal triangles. And so this is a kind of a different way of decomposing a genus 2 surface.
So in the olden days, we used to think about gluing that together with by studying hyperbolic
hexagons. Yeah.
So this is, what's the advantage of this point of view?
Because in a moment I'm going to dimension 3. And hexagons don't work in dimension 3, and ideal simplices do. So there's another way to think of this construction in dimension 2. Actually, it works in all dimensions. It's the so-called Epstein-Penner construction. So it's another way to think about how to make an ideal triangulation of a surface. Actually, it produces an ideal cell decomposition of a hyperbolic manifold of any number of dimensions with one cusp. And it does even more than that, actually. It gives you a canonical cell decomposition. So what I'm about to tell you gives you a complete topological invariant of a finite volume one cusp manifold in dimension 3 or more. So in particular, if you have a hyperbolic knot, what I'm about to say is a complete knot invariant for hyperbolic knots. So how does this work? So in dimension 2, we're back with the light cone model. With the hyperboloid model of the hyperbolic plane, except I haven't put the hyperboloid in. It would be the surface z squared is x squared plus y squared plus 1 inside this cone. Instead, actually, I put in the projective model, the disk at height 1. And so I'm thinking about a hyperbolic surface, actually, in the illustration, a once punctured torus, a hyperbolic surface with one cusp. And so the universal cover of this surface is the hyperbolic plane, which I'm now thinking of as a projective model. So here's the projective model of the hyperbolic plane. And this cusp point, this cusp corresponds to, I can fix some point on the circle at infinity. Actually, there are many corresponding to that parabolic fixed point. So that's the point P. Now I've gone upwards on the light cone. So I've taken this point P and just moved it upwards, just for clarity. And now the fundamental group of this hyperbolic surface is a group of isometries here. And in this case, the group of isometries I'm thinking of as a subgroup of SO21, thought of as isometries of the hyperbolic plane. So gamma is the... H2, this is the hyperbolic plane mod gamma, this punctured torus. So now I'm going to take this point P. Well, I've taken, I had a point P. I've scaled it to get a point P tilde on this light cone. This actually has no effect when you have one cusp. If you have more than one cusp, you have choices to make. You could, if you want, take P tilde to be here, to be the point at height 1. Any point works. Now you take the orbit under this group. So what you get is a collection of points on the light cone. So we've got the light cone, we've got this cone in R3 coming out of the origin, a collection of points on it. So that's this, this set, gamma times, and that should be a P tilde, of course. Now we take the convex hull. So we have this set in Euclidean 3 space. We take the convex hull. And the convex hull of that set of points is a convex polytope sitting up inside the light cone. It's this convex polytope. And the boundary of that convex polytope, it's made of various flat faces, two-dimensional flat faces. Take those two-dimensional flat faces and radially project them back down into the hyperbolic plane, thought of as the disk model. And what you'll see, each one of those faces will project to a convex polygon in the plane. So there I drew a square that could be, maybe there's another one which is a triangle, and so on. In fact, all those spaces, they will tessellate the hyperbolic plane. And if we take one representative face in each orbit, that will give a fundamental domain for the hyperbolic surface. So what this produces is a canonical... So here, the choice of point you make has no effect. Here what you get is a canonical collection of convex polygons. And, of course, if you take them and glue them together, you recover this surface. So that's the canonical cell decomposition for this surface. And what I've just said actually works in any number of dimensions. So in particular, for a hyperbolic knot, this produces a finite number of ideal three-dimensional convex polytopes. And they're uniquely determined up to isometry by the topology of the knot. And you have face pairings, and so the data of those isometry classes of those cells together with the face pairings is a complete invariant of the hyperbolic knot.
Are some of these faces not triangles?
Yeah, no, you're right. And in fact, it's a conjecture that in general, definitely some of the faces are not triangles. There are certainly examples where you have faces with more than three sides, yeah.
But what's the fundamental domain in several of those faces?
Sorry?
You said something about fundamental domain. How many of those ways get the fundamental domain?
Right, for a surface, for a surface, generically, each face will be a triangle, and the number of triangles will be the area divided by 2 pi. Right. For a hyperbolic three-manifold, there's no a priori bound on the number of faces. It can be probably arbitrarily, it can be arbitrarily large, of course.
Well, what you see in that projection model picture is you see infinitely many faces.
You see infinitely many, but there are finitely many orbits of face, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's not clear how to group them together to get one fundamental domain.
No. There you would make choices. So what's canonical here is a cell decomposition. You get a canonical number of pieces together with instructions how to glue them.
And what happens is you vary the parabolic point.
If you move this point up and down, nothing at all. And of course, if you pick a different point in the orbit,
yeah,
nothing at all. If you have a surface with two cusps, then their relative heights are important. So if you have a two-cusp manifold. Now we want to do the same thing for three-manifolds. So if you have an ideal triangle, all ideal triangles are isometric. Hyperbolic three-space, I'm thinking of as the interior of the unit ball, and the boundary of that ball is the Riemann sphere. So an ideal three-simplex, we have 4 points on the sphere at infinity, the Riemann sphere. And after applying a Möbius transformation, I can assume those points are 0, 1, infinity, and a fourth point, z. So the conclusion is that isometry classes of ideal three-simplex are in 1-1 correspondence with points in the Riemann sphere other than 0, 1, infinity. This number z depends on choice. There are some choices here, actually. What I just said, I should have said isometries that where they preserve the labeling of the vertices. I've decided this vertex is going to go to 0, this 1, this infinity, this z. In other words, I've got the permutation group on 4 elements acting here. So it turns out that there are actually 3 different versions of this parameter depending on the labeling. So each edge of the ideal three-simplex gets assigned a complex number in this way. And opposite edges are assigned the same complex number. So these blue edges, these red edges, and these black edges. And the reason for that, I mean, the fact that opposite edges are assigned the same complex number is that if you have a pair of geodesics in hyperbolic space, a pair of blue geodesics, there's a unique common perpendicular between them. And then if you do a half rotation, a pi rotation around that geodesic, of course, these two, because these two blue geodesics are orthogonal, they're mapped to themselves. So these red geodesics get swapped. And so what this means, if you think about it, that this half turn is actually an isometry. If you have any ideal 3 simplex, there is an isometry, which is a half turn, through the kind of midpoints of opposite edges, and it swaps the other two pairs of opposite edges. So given that isometry, that tells you the labels on opposite edges are the same. Furthermore, if you think what's going on, if we think about this point at infinity, in the Riemann sphere, we've got these points 0, 1, and z. So those points 0, 1, and z, if I project downwards this ideal triangle onto the Riemann sphere, I get a Euclidean triangle in the complex plane. So in this example, I mean, you can think of as A being 0, B being 1, Z being C, and infinity is infinity. And then what this parameter Z is, well, it's the ratio of it's this complex number divided by that complex number. In other words, it's C minus A divided by B minus A. In other words, the argument of that complex number is this angle. So one should think of this edge parameter as a kind of complex angle. It's got a modulus as well. And staring at this picture and doing the basic algebra, you discover that the if you change the labeling, which ones you call 0, 1, infinity, z, you see that this z0, this edge parameter, I'm thinking of as assigned to the edge coming out of A and going to infinity. So these other parameters, z1 and z2, are related to z0 by these equations. So any one determines the other by these equations. So the summary is that the modulus of an ideal simplex is determined by a complex number. To be more precise, you get to assign a complex number to one edge, and then that determines complex numbers on the other, all of the edges, according to this rule. And now, in order to get... So the next step is to assemble... We want to think of a hyperbolic 3 manifold as made by gluing together ideal 3 simplices. And this time, there's a condition. If you have a hyperbolic 3 manifold which is made by gluing together some ideal simplices by identifying faces by isometries, this time there is no choice when you glue two 3 simplices together. In the two-dimensional case, if you take two ideal triangles, you have a real number's worth of choices for how you identify an edge of one ideal triangle with an edge of another. For the 3 simplex, if you take two 3 simplices and glue them together along an ideal triangular face, there are no choices. Well, if you know the combinatorics of how they're going to glue together, then there's a unique isometry of an ideal triangle to itself that fixes the 3 vertices at infinity. So there are kind of no choices when you come to assemble these ideal simplices to make the 3 manifold. The parameters here are in the 3 simplices themselves, not when you come to glue them together. On the other hand, there is an equation, there is a constraint that comes from every edge. When you glue these 3 simplices together to produce a manifold, there's a condition around every edge in the glued up 3 manifold, and the condition is that the product of the edge invariants coming from the simplices arranged around that edge, the product of those edge invariants should be 1. Actually, it's a bit stronger than this. We should really require that the sum of the logarithms is 2 pi I. The sum of the angles around the edge has to be 2 pi rather than a multiple of 2 pi, which is all this equation gives us. So that's the so-called edge equation. And I think I just said that. So, if one has a so the figure 8 knot is an example of a 3 manifold, the complement of the figure 8 knot in the 3 sphere, which has a hyperbolic structure that can be made by taking 2 ideal hyperbolic 3 simplices and gluing the faces together in a certain combinatorial way. And when you do that, there are these edge conditions on the... So here we have the figure 8 knot, there are 2 ideal 3 simplices. Each one has got a parameter, so there are 2 parameters, z and w, one for each ideal 3 simplex. Then there's an equation that those parameters have to satisfy coming from going around an edge. And it turns out that when you glue, for the figure 8 knot, when you glue make these identifications down in the 3 manifold, there are 2 equivalence classes of edge. You actually get 2 equations, but they say the same thing. So if you take these 3 simplices and glue them together so that the gluing equations are satisfied, you get a hyperbolic structure on the 3 manifold, but it might not be complete in the same way that we saw in dimension 2. So there's an extra condition that called the cusp completeness condition. There's an extra requirement on these edge parameters to get a complete hyperbolic structure. And the way to think of this is that if one glues together a collection of ideal simplices and the edge equations are satisfied, then each torus boundary component will inherit a similarity structure. So where does the similarity structure come from? So one has pictorially you have this a 3 manifold maybe with a single torus cusp. Here's this torus. And there's an ideal triangulation. We have all these ideal 3 simplices. And the ends of the ideal 3 simplices can go out into this cusp. They crash through a cross-sectional torus in a triangle. So each ideal 3 simplex has kind of got 4 ends. Each one of those 4 ends is going to contribute a triangle to this torus. So if we have a solution of the edge equations, we've glued together some ideal 3 simplices by isometries, we have a hyperbolic metric as a result on this 3 manifold. But it might be that it's not complete. And the way you determine that is that you look how these 3 simplices crash through this torus. See, now you see a triangulation of the torus. And each one of these triangles you can think of as a projection of an ideal 3 simplex onto the complex plane where one of the vertices is at infinity. So what you actually have here is a Euclidean 2 simplex. Now, if you think about what... So the group of Mobius transformations fixing the point at infinity, those are the Mobius transformations that send z to az plus b. Those are Euclidean similarities. So we've got this three manifold obtained by gluing together ideal three simplices. When you look in the universal cover, what that tells you about the induced structure on the cusp, you have a structure with Euclidean simplices, but the holonomy in general is not by Euclidean transformations, it's by Euclidean similarities. The condition that you actually have a complete structure is that this similarity structure is actually a Euclidean structure. That's the requirement that each one of these multiplying number, each one of these factors is 1. So it's actually a Euclidean isometry rather than a Euclidean similarity. Actually, I'm simplifying a bit. So in this example, here I've got a similarity structure on a torus coming from just two triangles. So this actually can't arise in a one cusp manifold, but never mind. If you compute the holonomy of the group element, so the fundamental group of the torus is Z plus Z, there's a group element sending this edge to this edge, and the holonomy is given by the product of these two edge invariants, Z and W. Now that needs to be, well, that's actually the rotational part of the holonomy, that's this factor A here. So in fact, you get an extra requirement, and the extra requirement is that a certain product of edge invariants is 1, which corresponds to this statement. In general, I mean, the holonomy of every element in the boundary torus needs to be a Euclidean isometry rather than a similarity. But in fact, once you impose the requirement that one element in the boundary is a translation, the fact the fundamental group's abelian tells you that the other elements are translation as well. So if you have a one cusp manifold, there's a single extra equation you add, which is a certain product of edge invariants you read off from the combinatorics here. That's the condition for a complete hyperbolic structure. I think that's it.
So there's no definite scale on that thing? Like, you're identifying...
No, I mean, no, there's no definite scale. I mean, if you move this torus outwards, it shrinks exponentially. So, but if you kind of fix a cross section, yeah. So there's, yeah.
So the knot invariant you mentioned is inputs a knot and outputs a triangulation of the torus.
No, the knot invariant, you input a knot and it outputs a collection of ideal polyhedra, isometry classes of ideal polyhedra, and the combinatorics of how they're glued together. And that's a complete invariant.
So